We're going to do something different than what I normally do on Sunday night. Since nobody's interested in the football game, the only one that's wearing a t-shirt that's correct is Chris. Somebody forgot to tell Gina Dallas that name. She must have done it to support me being the quarterback of the Dallas Cowboys. And then Vicky's got on San Diego back there. So, you know, in that nobody's got the t-shirts, we can figure that there's only one fan tonight. What I'd like to do this evening is to look at the whole of Ezekiel chapters 40 to 48. Now, obviously, I'm not going to preach chapters 40 to 48. There is no way possible I can do that unless you all don't have to be anywhere until next Thursday. At that point, I could probably start now and we could get through it. Chapters 40 to 48 are the last series of messages, and they're connected all together because when you look in Ezekiel chapter 40 and you look at the introductory verse, it says, "And in the 25th year of our exile, at the beginning of the year, on the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year after Jerusalem had been captured, on that very day, the Lord's hand was on me and brought me from there." So all of these messages came after Jerusalem had fallen and had been fallen for 14 years. That's a long time. So now everybody, he's not preaching as he was earlier on when there were still people in Jerusalem, when Jerusalem was still under siege and Babylon was still threatening. It's already happened. Jerusalem is ransacked. The walls are torn down. The temple has been decimated. And all of the objects of worship are used in worship, not of worship. Though for them, it comes to seem that those were worshipped as well. Everything's been taken away from Jerusalem into captivity with the people. And as God's glory had departed from the temple and from Jerusalem, so we find that Ezekiel's looking ahead to the future. Now, if you were to describe, let's say, to the generation of 1901 to 1914, if you were to describe the electronic media and the means by which we communicate today, would they have any foggy clue? Yeah, they wouldn't have a clue. 1914, put them 100 years ago. If you were to talk about, iPads, iPods, iPhones, Kindle, and all right, well, smartphones are iPhones, iPads. You know, your internet, just the whole idea of internet. If you talked about flash drives, hard drives, if you talked about any kind of computer system at all, and that's old news, that's old school, keypads, we don't use the. You realize that last year was the last year that regular old manual typewriters were manufactured? The manufacturing of typewriters is obsolete. They don't make them anymore. Manual typewriters are gone. It's a thing of the past, and yet that was very much in the foe. And so to describe for them what we experience now, you'd have to use something of comparison and contrast, but primarily comparison. And so you'd either have to use a simile or a metaphor. Now, when I say those two words, you've heard those words before, right? Everyone's heard the words simile and metaphor. But not everybody knows how to make a distinction between what one is. They've heard it, but it's kind of like the distinction between a limousine cow or a Holstein and a Jersey cow. You know that they're cows that give milk, but to know the difference, unless you're a farmer or grew up on a farm, you probably don't have a clue which one's which, right? If you were in a barn, it'd be kind of like the Houston Livestock Show when they bring a reporter in from New York and he's there looking at the heifers and he's trying to figure out what the judge is looking for in a heifer, a steer, what he's looking for in different livestock, and he sees a bull and it's been, you know, blow-dried in its hooves, painted, and he can't tell the difference between a cow and a bull. He doesn't have a clue. You know, so to use a metaphor and a simile, we know the words, but we may not recognize them. A metaphor is when you say, this is this, or this is that. This is my blood, which is poured out for you. Take, drink of it. All right? How many of us understand that that when we drink the grape juice at the table, that that's really not the blood of Christ? How many of us know that? That it's a metaphor. All right. Now, Martin Luther had trouble with that because he said, this is my blood, which is poured out for you. Take and drink. He says, you know, he said, this is it, so it must be it. He had trouble distinguishing a metaphor from what was being said, and so it somehow or another has to be the blood of Christ, when in reality it's a metaphor. For certainly Christ's blood was still in his veins. He had not yet been crucified when he said, this is my body, this is my blood. Take, eat, take, drink. So a metaphor is to say, this is that. I am the door. I am the good shepherd. All of these are metaphors. They're some kind of analogy comparison. A simile is when you say something is like that, using like or as. And so we know what a simile is. Well, when we come to chapters 40 to 48, we have the reinstitution of the sacrificial system. We have Jerusalem rebuilt. We have the temple rebuilt. And we have worship reinstituted. Now, for someone who has never seen, they know that Christ is coming, but for someone who has never seen or known of Christ, of the incarnation, or of the life, death, and burial, resurrection, and ascension of Christ, to talk to them about Christ would be like talking to someone in 1914 or 1904 and talking to them about the difference between an 8-track tape and some kind of an iPad, iTunes, or MP3. They'd look at you like a calf at the new gate, like a deer in the headlights. They'd be stunned. They wouldn't know what you're talking about, correct? All right, so ma'am, you still don't know what I'm talking about. All right? And so for them here in 586, actually 586 is when Jerusalem fell, so you had 14 years, or take 14 years away from that, you're what, 572. So in 572 B.C., to talk to them about Jesus Christ and the accomplishment of his death on the cross, that it has completely satisfied sin, it's foreign to them. Because the only way that they've ever known to worship God was where? In the temple. And the only means of forgiveness and atonement and the remission of guilt was through what? The sacrificial system. You had to kill a goat, a bull, a sheep or a turtle dove, something had to die and blood had to be poured. And so to describe to them something other than that, they would not have a clue. It'd be like talking to the Civil War generation about space exploration and about having people, you know, in a laboratory out in space that can stay there for months. It'd be foreign to them. They would not comprehend, could not understand it. And so for Ezekiel to look ahead by the hand of God to see these things, then it is to him and to his generation something that would be impossible to comprehend. And so when we come to interpreting what's known as eschatology, eschaton means last. So eschatology is the study of what the last things are going to be. When we come to looking at the end, and we live in the eschaton, we live in the last days. Jesus said we're in the last days. Peter said we're in the last days. So guess what? We're in the last days. We are in this eschatological period that they're looking forward to. We're experiencing it. We live in it. We're not awaiting it. The last day is still out there. We're in the last days. So we're in this period of interim from Christ's ascension until Christ's return. And so for us, when we look at this, it's foreign to us to look back and see the sacrificial system. We have a hard time to be able to put our minds around going back to that. Well, in eschatological systems, and again, that seems like a big word, but that's the word that it is, there are two primary systems. And one is called dispensational theology, which that is not taboo. It's not a bad word. It's not scary. You don't have to be afraid of it. In fact, to be honest with you, we all owe much to dispensationalism. If it were not for dispensationalism, actually taking what God has said about the future, if it were not for taking that seriously, then we had generations of people that just looked at it and just blew it off. John Calvin wrote a commentary on every book of the Bible, but he did not touch Revelation. Why? Because he looked at it and says, I don't have a clue what it's talking about. I don't know what it's about. And he says, so I can't talk about what I don't know. And he just left it alone. But he's not the only one. And then others who came to it looked and tried to just spiritualize it away. Well, you know, that's got to be that the devil was bound at the time that Christ died. And so now we live in this period of time. The millennium is now. It's not later. And so we live in this period of time where Satan is bound. I don't think he's too bound to me. He looks pretty loose. And, you know, so Satan's bound and the church is going to triumph, and the church is going to become the dominant force in all the world. And so that was postmillennialism. And on the dispensationalism, you would know it from Scofield Reference Bible or from the New Scofield Reference Bible, from John MacArthur, from Ryrie's Study Bible, and all good men. I've benefited from them. You have benefited from them. In fact, this church was started with dispensational theology. I don't know if you know that, but the pastor that started this church left First Baptist Church over dispensationalism. And so we have our lifeblood in dispensationalism, and it's just the facts. So dispensationalism looks at different periods in the age, and that God uses in different economies. He deals with people differently, and so we're in this church age, and there will be a millennial age that's to follow. And there's generally seven dispensations, from Adam and innocence to government. To the period where governments failed, and then you have the law with Moses, then you have the promise, then you have the fulfillment of that coming with Christ. He came to the Jews rejected him, Matthew 13, so there was a break and a separation. God took up his economy with the Gentiles that began in Matthew chapter 14, and it runs until the ascension of the church when we're pre-tribulated out of here, and then he takes up his economy with the Israel again, in the tribulation period, and then at the end of the tribulation period, when the church is already gone, then the great battle comes, and Satan's bound, and a millennial kingdom here on earth with the Jews for 1,000 years, and then the end all comes. That's dispensationalism as a whole. And there's much of it that is credible and that we ought to hold to, except there's always an except. It doesn't put all the pieces together, and it throws too many things in. And so one of the things, particularly with Scofield, was that he had two means of salvation, one for the Jews and one for the Gentiles. And so there was two separate means of salvation. For the Jews, it was a sacrificial system. It was a law. For us, it's all of grace. And see, some hold to that and don't understand why they hold to that, except because dispensationalism has become so prominent that it's just part of who we are, because we've heard it so much we don't know to put it together any differently. Well, what's our options? And our option would be an all-millennial or covenantal position. But the problem with covenantal position is the same thing we saw in Genesis if you were here on Wednesday night. The covenantal position, you have a covenant head, and everything goes to the head. So for Noah was the head of those that entered into the ark. And so David is the head of this generation, in the same way Christ is the head of this covenant that God's made with us, this covenant of grace, and so we have a relationship to that. Well, the problem with covenantal theology, and it's the reason why there's infant baptism, is because of the head. Since the head believes the right thing, then the children all come in, and we bring them into the covenant through infant baptism. And so it doesn't have any regard to their own personal faith. We bring them in by baptizing them, and then they grow, and eventually they become part of the covenant community because they decide on their own to become part of this covenant community. And the reality is there's only one way to enter into this covenant, and the only head is Jesus Christ. There's only one way to come. And the only way to come into this covenant relationship with God is through Jesus Christ. And so for each one of us, we entered in. How? How did you come to be in this covenant of grace where God made promises to Jesus and you become the heir of those promises? How did you enter into that? How did it become yours? I've been reading some of your testimonies. So some of you have been delinquent. I don't know if you're afraid that I'm going to correct your grammar, because I will not. I promise you. I will not correct the spelling. I will not correct the grammar. But what am I looking for? Well, I'll be honest with you. I haven't received very many. But one that I received doesn't give the right answer. And see, that's what I'm afraid of. Is I'm afraid that there's not just one that's not given the right answer. I think others may have the wrong notion of how do you come into this covenant of grace. How do you come into this experience to know Christ is your head and you as his body? How do you come in to become a son, a daughter of God, and to enter into the inheritance of God? Many have said, well, I was baptized when I was 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 13. And I started doing good things. and I started doing this, and I started doing this. And the one thing that's missing in all of that, because, see, I could have been baptized when I was 6 days old. I could have been baptized when I was 2 days old. And that would have been no more effective for me than being baptized at 6, 12, or 13. There's only one way to enter into this covenant relationship with God, and that is through faith in Jesus Christ. He is to whom the promises were made. Galatians chapter 3, verse 16. You and I become the sons of Abraham because the promises made to Abraham are fulfilled in Jesus Christ. Christ is the covenant head. And when I come into faith in Jesus Christ, Galatians 4 says that I have become an heir. I join into this covenant, and I have a share in it because of my relationship to Jesus Christ. So when I come into this relationship, then I start thinking about, well, what about the temple? What about the law? And for anybody, what about the temple? What about the law? What about the sacrificial system? And what's its function? What's its role for me? What's the role of the Mosaic law? And we find that Ezekiel puts these things out there. And for dispensationalists, because they have two separate ways of salvation, one for the Jews and one for Gentiles, or one for the church age and one for the law age, and the law will come back again, then you've got to have the sacrificial system. And they will point to Ezekiel as defending that, but it's indefensible. Because there's only one way of salvation. And there's only one way to get to God. For Abraham, for you, and for me. There's just one way. And that is enter into a covenant with God. For as many as would receive him, to them he gave the right to become sons and daughters of God. To those who received him by faith. Not of themselves, but of God. Being born again of God. And so I think it's that important to take this evening for that. So when we think about the sacrificial system, what's its function and what's its role? Well, I guess I oughtn't to get ahead of myself. We look at chapters 40 to 48, and I'll give you a quick synopsis of all of them. Chapter 40 is a mountaintop experience, and he comes to the top of the mountain. He looks down the south side. He sees a man there, and he's got a measuring rod, and we see the same picture when we look in Zechariah. And in Zechariah, particularly chapter 2, we find a man with a measuring rod, and he goes to measure Jerusalem because it's going to be rebuilt. And so we find here he is there. And he begins to measure the walls for the outer gates and the inner gates and rooms for sacrifices and rooms for the choir. So you've got five parts of this. But the one thing that stands out is what he says in verse 4. In verse 4, he says, "Son of man, look with your eyes and listen with your ears and pay attention to everything I'm going to show you. For you have been brought here so that you might show it, so that it I might show it to you. Report everything that you see to the house of Israel." So what we see here, we find here in chapter 40, verse 4, we find that Ezekiel is told to look, to see, to listen, and report. And then when we get to chapter 44, and we're halfway through this thing, guess what? The second half of this, so 40 to 42, or 3, is one half, and 44 to 48 becomes the other half, because when we get to verse 4, and verse 5 of chapter 44, it says, "The man brought me by way of the north gate to the front of the temple. I looked, and the glory of the Lord filled his temple, and I fell down on my face. And the Lord said to me, 'Son of man, pay attention, look, and listen with your ears to everything I'm about to tell you about the statutes and the laws of the Lord's temple, and take careful note that of the entrance of the temple along with the exits of the sanctuary.'" And so we find this, pay attention, look, and listen becomes the structure for this. Chapter 41, we have the Lord's sanctuary in the temple and the appointments. So the first four verses, we have inside the temple. On the 5 to 15, we have outside the temple. 15 to 26, we have the wooden structures that compose the inside of the temple. And so the temple's described. Chapter 42, we have mansions. And we have instructions to the priests. And so the first 14 verses are the priest's chambers. Just a note, John 14, 1 to 5. You believe in God? Believe also in me. In my Father's house, what? There are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. But I'm going to prepare a place for you. And if I go prepare a place for you, then I will come again, so that where I am, there you may be also. We find the priest, are given quarters within the temple of God, and the dimensions in 15 to 20 of the temple are described. Chapter 43 ends the first section. We saw that God's glory left Israel. It went out the eastern gate, went up the Mount of Olives, and it was gone. God had left. And the people say, well, God doesn't see because God's gone. Well, we find that God comes back. And God's going to restore his people. There's a restoration. And so chapter 43 in verses 1 to 12, God's glory comes back. And how do you not know God's glory comes back? Because the altar is there, a place of worship in 13 to 27. And then 44 goes to the second half. And in chapter 44, again, I've mentioned verses 1 to 5. Look, or pay attention, look and listen, see. And so his instructions. And so in the first five verses, it says that the prince will eat in the presence of Yahweh. That the king is going to eat in God's presence. And so I think about Revelation chapter 19. And I think about our prince, the king. And he takes and invites us to come and sit where? At a banquet table. And the banquet table is a table prepared for his bride. Ephesians chapter 5 says that we are the bride of Christ and that he has prepared for himself a bride without spot and without wrinkle. How? By washing us through regeneration and the word and by the Spirit. And so you find the picture of Yahweh having accepted the prince and the prince in his temple. Verses 6 to 14, there's accusations against the uncircumcised priest, both in heart and in flesh. And you remember we've already looked and seen that God says, I'm going to take out the stony heart and I'm going to put in a heart of flesh. And he looks at regeneration, I'll pour out my spirit upon them. And so there's this warning, this accusation about people who have come to be a part of this, and yet they're not regenerated. Because the fleshly heart is regeneration. And so we find that he says, that he's going to give us a new heart. And then he gives instructions in 15 to 31 to the priest. And then we come to chapter 45. And he makes special arrangements for the priests. And so the priests have land portion. Now, let me remind you, one of the key articles among Baptists, but it's among Protestants. One of the key articles is we believe in the priesthood of whom? All believers. And so when you look at 1 Peter chapter 2, he describes us as being stones, living stones, brought together into a temple, and that we offer up spiritual worship to the Lord. And so that's what God offers to us. That's what we do. We worship God, and we come together to worship God. And so as we see, he gives us a portion. There's a place. And then again, in verses 9 to 12, we find an accusation against the dishonest princes and their injustice. 13 to 20, everybody brings an offering. Not a sacrifice. Everybody brings an offering. It is expected that everybody that comes to worship God brings an offering. Now, I don't preach much on tithing, do I? But I'm telling you that it is inseparable from worship. We bring to God, it is out of honor, it is out of respect, it is out of due. God wants the cheerful heart. But when we come as God's people, renewed and regenerated, we come and bring offerings to God. And the reinstitution of the Passover was a great revival. You remember in the days of Josiah, they had neglected, the Passover had not been celebrated for generations. And all of a sudden, it wasn't Passover time, but they celebrated the Passover. Why? Because it is a sign of revival. It's a sign of recognizing of God's deliverance and God's presence, God's work, God's glory. And so when we think about that, Jesus Christ, of all the feasts that he could have identified himself with, which one did he identify himself with? The Day of Atonement? No, that's in August. Feast of Tabernacles? No, that's in October. Feast of Pentecost? No, that's in May, June. What feast did he recognize himself with, identify himself with? The Passover. And so we find that coming to worship God, we come, again, we enter into this time where God passes over us. God excuses us, as it were, because Passover means to trip, to hop, to skip. He skips over us. And then in chapter 46, we find regulations for the offerings. The appointed feast, in the first 15 verses, the prince is forbidden to steal the land inheritances of the people in 16 to 18, and the priest kitchen. The priests are going to cook. And so they got to have a place to cook. So there's going to be a kitchen. You know, when they say Baptists are always, you know, one of the key spiritual gifts of Baptists is the gift of cooking. And if the kid, the Baptist kid, when asked by his teacher, you know, all the kids were told to bring something that a symbol of their faith to school. And so the little Jewish boy brought his menorah, and the little Catholic boy brought his cross, and the little Baptist kid brought his casserole. you know, that's okay. It's biblical. The priests are going to have a kitchen, but you're going to love that. Yeah, we got a place to cook, and we will bring our offerings before the Lord. Chapter 47. I know that I remember things that probably I shouldn't remember and don't remember things I ought to. But I remember John Pretlove preaching from John chapter 7. You remember John Pretlove, the British guy? The first thing he said is, you know, the Sin City isn't Las Vegas. You know, he's living in Las Vegas and talking about the Prince Charles and the wedding and talking about, now you see, you don't remember that part of it, do you? His prologue before he came in and preached. But he preached from John chapter 7, but he really preached from Ezekiel chapter 47. And he connected the river flowing out of the temple to what? To the Holy Spirit, to the coming of the Holy Spirit, and to the life of God that comes out of the city. And then the borders, Israel's borders are given again in chapters 13, or verses 13 to 23, and chapter 48, the new city with a new name. The tribal allotments, the land provision. When I think about Ephesians chapter 2, verses 11 down to the end of the chapter, it says that you and I, we once were uncircumcised, and we were called that by those who were circumcised, but only in the flesh. Theirs was merely outwardly, and it wasn't inwardly. But now we are circumcised, but it's not outwardly, it's all inwardly. Our heart's been changed. We got a new heart. And we once didn't have the promises, but now we have them all. And we once did not have the commonwealth of Israel, which is the land. We had no land promise, but now we do. And once we had no Christ, but now we do have. And once we had no God, but now we do have. And once we had no hope, but now we got a great hope. It's a living hope because of the resurrection of Christ. So here we find the land allotments of the tribes and begin to realize, you know what? We have a land apportionment from God as well. We have an inheritance. And then he says the restoration of the city. And the last two words of the book of Ezekiel are, the Lord is there. Now, I know that's three in English, but in Hebrew it is Yahweh Shema. And that's it. Yahweh, there. And that's the name of the city. God's there. God's presence is there. So I asked myself, well, why in the world would we look for something of a sacrificial system? It has to presuppose upon a distinction between Jews and Gentiles and a means of salvation, both in the past dispensation and in the future dispensation, after a pre-tribulation rapture of the church, if that were to be the case. Well, we come, and I'd like, first of all, to take you to the book of Hebrews. And in Hebrews, really from chapter 3 all the way over to chapter 8, we find the priesthood and the contrast between the old priesthood and the new priesthood, and about the old sanctuary and the new sanctuary. And so that Christ is the greater high priest. His high priesthood is one that passes away, but he's much like in chapter 7, he's much like Melchizedek, the king of righteousness from the city of Salem, the city of peace, and that it's not based upon laws, but God has introduced a new, in verse 19 of chapter 7, God's introduced a new, better hope, through which we are able to draw near to God. Why? Because we have a new priest. It's not like the old Aaronic priesthood. We have a new priest before God. Chapter 8, it says, we have this kind of high priest who sat down at the right hand of God, and at the right hand of God, of the throne of God, of the majesty in heaven, a minister of a sanctuary and a true tabernacle, which the Lord set up and not man. And then in verse 5, he says, these other things only served as a copy and a shadow of the heavenly things, as Moses was warned when he was about to complete the tabernacle, for he said, be careful that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain. But Jesus has now obtained a superior ministry, and to that degree, he is the mediator of a better covenant, which has been legally enacted by better promises. And then he talks about the ministry and the sacrificial system in chapters 9 and 10. And he talks about Christ being the perfect sacrifice. And so we come to verse 26 of chapter 9, and he says, otherwise he would have had to suffer many times since the foundation of the world. But now he has appeared one time at the end of the ages for the removal of sin by a sacrifice of himself. And just as it was appointed for the people to die once, and after this the judgment, so also the Messiah, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time, not to bear sin, but to bring salvation to those who are waiting for him. Is there a need for a new sacrificial system? Will there be a need for a millennial sacrificial system? Absolutely not. Why? Because we have a great high priest who, having suffered once, and dying for us, has raised to sit at God's right hand. The sacrifice has been completely satisfied. It would be absolutely ludicrous to even imagine that there would be the necessity. Well, you know, it is mentioned, well, it's a memorial, kind of like coming to the Lord's Supper. Well, for some, this is a memorial, but for some, it's the real sacrifice. For some, it's the reoffering and sacrificing of Christ every time that it's gathered together, because in the priest's blessing, in the blessing, those elements are transformed, and now it's not bread and it's not wine, it is blood and it's flesh, and Christ is sacrificed anew every time that it is offered. Or to go with Luther, something happened in the blessing, and I know that's still wine, and I know that's still bread, but somehow or another there's a co-mingling, and so the blood's in the wine, and the bread, and the flesh is in the blood, so when we eat that, it's more than a memorial. There is no necessity. In fact, it would be decrying to look to something else other than Christ to offer such sacrifices. Well, why would there be even the concept or the necessity of that idea? Well, particularly one, and there are a few others, but very few. And one would be at the end of Zechariah. In Zechariah, when it looks at the Lord coming in that last great battle, when he comes to Jerusalem after Jerusalem is about to fall, it's been sieged, they've wreaked havoc upon the land, and we find that Christ is there, verse 6, on that day there will be no light, the sunshine or moonlight will diminish. It will be a day known only to Yahweh, without day, without night, but there will be light at evening. And it begins to talk about all that's going to transpire. And then in verse 12, to the end of the chapter, it says, and this will be the plague the Lord strikes all people with who have warred against Jerusalem. Their flesh will rot while they stand on their feet. Their eyes will rot in their sockets, and their tongues will rot in their mouths. On that day, a great panic from the Lord will be among all of them, so that each will seize the hand of another, and the hand of one will rise against the other. And Judah will also fight Jerusalem, and the wealth of all the surrounding nations will be collected, gold and silver and clothing in great abundance, and the same plague as the previous one will strike the horses, the mules, the camels, the donkeys, and all the animals that are in those camps. Then the survivors from the nations that came against Jerusalem will go up year after year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, to celebrate the Feast of Booths. Should any family on the earth not go up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts will reign, rain will not fall on them. And if the people of Egypt will not go up and enter, then the rain will not fall on them. And this will be a plague the Lord inflicts on the nations who do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Booths. And this will be a punishment of Egypt and all the nations that do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Booths. And on that day, the words, Kodesh de la Yahweh, it's on your gazebo up in the rafters, holy to the Lord, will be written on everything. On the bells of the horses, on the pots in the houses of the Lord, will be like the sprinkling basins before the altar. Every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah will be holy to the Lord. And everyone who sacrifices will come and take some of the pots to cook in. On that day, there will be no longer a Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts. And so they look and say, well, there's sacrifices, you know, and they're coming together to celebrate the Feast of Booths during this time. So obviously there's got to be the reinstitution of sacrifices. What period of time is Zechariah? He is predecessor to Ezekiel. For 70 years of captivity, from 586 until 520, you have Jerusalem in exile. And then Jerusalem, the Israelites come back at the decree of Cyrus. And when they come back in, by 516, they have reinstituted the altar and they're offering up sacrifices. And so all again, all they know, they don't know of Christ. They know Christ is coming. They know there's something, but they don't know who he is. It's still in shadows, still in figures. So we'd expect that when we come to Revelation that we'd find some idea of a re-sacrificial system. But yet when we turn, and particularly turn to chapter 21 of Revelation and begin in verse 9, one of the things we find that is not there is sacrifices. There are no sacrifices to be made in a millennial period of time or in any other period of time. We can look at the millennial period of time. That's in chapter 20. And we find Satan bound for 1,000 years in verse 2. And that it will be this 1,000-year reign that when it's completed, and verse 4 or verse 3, after that he must be released for a short time. And then I saw thrones and people seated who were on them. And we find the judgment, and it says at the end of verse 4, they came to life and reigned with the Messiah for 1,000 years. And the rest of the dead did not come to life until the 1,000 years were completed. This is the first resurrection. Blessed and holy are those who have a share in the first resurrection. The second death has no power over these, but they will be priests of God and the Messiah. And they will reign with him for 1,000 years. Well, certainly there's got to be sacrifices if there are priests. And yet, that's not the only function of a priest. And so when it's completed, we find the battle of Gog and Magog. We just saw that in chapters 38 and 39 of Ezekiel, didn't we? We just spent, 4 weeks on Gog and Magog. And then the great white throne judgment. But when we come, then we're entered into the new heaven and new earth. There's no mention in chapter 20 at all of sacrifices or of a sacrificial system. None. And if it's going to be there, we'd expect to find it there, wouldn't we? But it's not there. And it seems to me that it's not even deemed necessary. There will be one during the 7-year period of the tribulation, but not in the millennium. And it will be the Jews who reinstitute it, not the church. And the church will have no part of that. So when you come to the New Jerusalem, you've got the city, and you've got the description in verses 9 down through the end of chapter 21. You've got the city walls that are described and all the beauty. Of all the architecture and the gates that are mentioned, just like in Ezekiel. And then he talks about the measuring rod, just like you have in chapter 40 of Ezekiel, the man with the measuring rod that's standing there measuring all of this out, describing the foundations in verse 19 of precious jewels and stones, to which we are all familiar of the pearls, the pearly gates in chapter 21, verse 21. And the city, like pure gold, translucent or transparent as glass. And I did not, look at verse 22, I did not see a sanctuary in it. I did not see a sanctuary. I didn't see a temple. I did not see a sanctuary in it because the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are the sanctuary. So when we come to worship, we don't come to worship at a temple. And though the Jews will reinstitute a temple service sometime before the coming of Christ during this tribulation period, there will not be the reinstitution under a Christian era or even under the Messiah. There will not be the reinstitution of sacrifices. So when we come to this, then we have to look at these. Then what's the purpose? What's the purpose of the metaphors? How else do you describe heaven and the things of heaven unless you use things that are familiar? If I want to tell somebody that is non-churched, I want to tell them what church is like. How do I describe it? Well, it's a bunch of people get together for a meeting, and they start out with singing, and, you know, somebody prays, and then some old dude gets up there and talks about stuff no one's interested in, half the congregation sleeps, and at the close of it, they say amen, play a song, and everybody goes. Well, some might describe it that way, right? But how would you describe it? What is the gathering of the church? How would you describe it to someone who doesn't know anything of it? Well, would you describe it as a business meeting? As a corporate, you know, when the corporate heads of departments come together and they sit down and strategize and they figure out how they're going to lead the company forward for the next year, is that what this is? Would you describe it as a family reunion? You know, when you all get together And all the family gets together and everybody brings some food and you spend, you know, a day or maybe a weekend together and hang out with family members you've not seen for a while and reconnect, and maybe some you didn't like and hope they didn't come show up anyway. You know, is that how you would describe, why, how do you describe the gathering of the church? I mean, really, it's an anomaly, it's a peculiarity, because there's not really any one metaphor, any one comparison that you could bring together to fit all the facets of this diamond and jewel in God's, in the glory and the crown of Jesus Christ. And so the only way that you can really describe the church and the gathering of the church is to point them to the glorious head. Not to look at the body, but to look at the head. For them to see the glory and the splendor and the wonder, the uniqueness and the beauty of Jesus Christ. We gather because we are gathering around him. When we gather, it's all about him. When we worship, we are magnifying and glorifying this one that we've never seen, as Peter said, yet we love, and we have joy that's beyond speech. We don't even know how to describe the joy that God's given us because of this, and we are looking and waiting for a salvation yet to be yet appear, and we know that this has been announced because the prophets were looking into what manner of time or person that the sufferings and the afterward glory was going to occur, and even the angels are stooping over heaven, and they're interested in looking into this great salvation that you and I have come to experience. So when we gather, we are coming together in amazement and in awe of the wonder of God as God has poured out his blessing upon us, and we're looking to find the wonder, the splendor of God in our own life, in our own experience. And we look at Christ and we see him in the complete and the final and the finished work of his sacrifice on the cross. And we know that God's accepted it. For when God showed himself upon his throne in Daniel chapter 7, when the Son of Man entered, God accepted him and welcomed him. And Hebrews says he sat down at the right hand of God. And now he intercedes for us and he is praying on our behalf. And he is welcoming each of us as we come into God's presence. Each and every time we come into God's presence, we come because Jesus Christ, our King, sits on his throne. How do you describe that to someone that has no concept of Jesus Christ in their life? It is overwhelming. It's amazing. And we never can come to enough. So I look at a deer that we kill and we butcher. We take, we chop it up and put it in packages and freeze it. We smell the blood. And I think to myself, there is no way. There is no way, whether it's a deer, a cow, a lamb, a goat, a turtle dove, there is no way that any of this can picture what Christ has done. It is dim, it is obscure, it's oblique at best, because when I see it in the face of Jesus Christ, it is overwhelming in glory. The lamb that was slain. To see him glorified and magnified, and I stand and I ask you to stand with me and the angels and to give Jesus Christ all glory and all honor and all praise and all power and all strength and all wealth, for he is worthy. And it says, and the elders said amen, and they fell on their face to worship, and the four living creatures bowed down and they worshiped. Christ has completed it all. We don't have to look anywhere else. So what we see in Ezekiel 40 to 48 is pictures of what heaven, pictures of what Christ, pictures of our inheritance, pictures of what God has done for you and me. And we ought to be overwhelmed when we listen to measurements that we may not comprehend, to know that God's made provision and plans for us, not only for now, but for all eternity. And we stand and say, we praise you, Lord Jesus Christ. As we sing, may God open your heart to rejoice.